Hello and welcome to the Money Marketing Podcast. I'm Lois Valerie, Chief Reporter. At the end of May, I attended the Initiative for Financial Wellbeing's annual conference in Bristol. And financial wellbeing is a topic that we at Money Marketing are very passionate about and are wanting to focus on more. So after attending the event, I wanted to chat to a few of the keynote speakers. Last episode, I spoke to Alison Gray, co-founder of Wealthy, all about her sort of thoughts on financial education and how that can help financial well-being. And in this episode, I'm joined by another of the keynote speakers, Dr. Thomas Mather, who is Insight Manager at Aegon UK's Centre for Behavioural Research. So, Thomas, perhaps you could tell our listeners a bit about you, what you do, and why financial well-being is so important for you.
Yeah, thank you. Great to be here. Thank you for having me. As you say, I head up this small outfit at Aegon that we have. We call the Center for Behavioral Research. This is a unit which is all about helping people address the biases and mental shortcuts that prevent them from living best lives. Okay, so this could be all sorts of things. It could be about, how to help people pay attention to their life goals rather than market volatility when there is market volatility, or how to overcome confirmation bias when potentially they're thinking that a financial advisor is not for them. A financial advisor is more for the wealthy, or for those who are in a certain sort of like social position. And then we do a lot in the financial well-being space, and financial well-being, to answer that question, is I think relevant for everyone. It's oftentimes these days, especially sort of reduced, perhaps that's a bit harsh, but oftentimes it is reduced to financial resilience only. So we have a lot of discussion on cost of living crisis, increased energy prices, inflation, increased taxes, etc. And that sort of like conveys the impression that financial well-being is all about those money-related aspects, when in actual fact, it's more than that. And we talk a lot about like future-oriented behavior. We talk about knowledge of what makes you happy, savvy social comparisons. So those types of things that we think are really important for sort of like more rounded, holistic, perhaps, understanding of financial well-being. But I would say it's relevant to everyone, really.
Yeah, definitely. And just sort of for the purposes of this conversation, what is it exactly you're talking about when you say financial well-being? What does it mean exactly?
Yeah, so it's, there's obviously, there's a lot of sort of definitions out there, a lot of contributions to this discussion. First of all, I wouldn't be saying like this is the one and only right definition of financial well-being. It's just one sort of like angle, and as you mentioned, this is from the Center for Behavioral Research, so we have a lot of sort of like behaviorally informed contribution to make to this discussion. And what we would say is financial well-being is comprised of two elements. It's comprised of money and it's comprised of mindset. On the money side, you would have your usual suspects of you need to have an income, you need to have safety nets, you should have manageable debt levels, you should be in a good sort of like long-term savings position, etc. So all those things that you would expect there to be when talking about financial resilience. But when we come to the mindset side, it's to do with those things that I touched on briefly a moment ago, which is to do with, do we have an understanding of the things, experiences, activities that give us joy and purpose in life? Okay, so joy is all about, feeling gratification, feeling relaxation, feeling happy. When purpose is all about, feeling worthwhile, useful, competent, etc. So you want to have this behavioral science that comes out of LSE's Paul Dolan, would argue that you need to have a sort of like even balance of pleasure moments and purpose moments. So but the question is, do you have an understanding of those things? And if not, perhaps your wealth position is actually not that powerful, because you can't actually use the wealth that you have so as to pursue the things that give you joy and purpose in life. I mentioned also like future-oriented behavior, having long-term mental time horizon. So we see that having a long-term mental time horizon, or a sort of like meaningful connection to your future self, has a lot of impact on how you conduct yourself financially in all sorts of realms, not just whether you're saving for retirement, retirement, but also, you know, how many, what your emergency saving position is like, what your debt position is like, all sorts of things you are conducting yourself on differently when you have that long-term mental time horizon. So that's something that we consider important. Savvy social comparisons. We talked a lot about this at the breakout session at the IFW's conference. It's all to do with, who you compare with and how you compare. There's a lot of evidence that shows that how much you possess is less important than how much you think you possess in comparison to others. Yeah, and there's lots of sort of like beautiful research that illustrates the point. My favorite one is a study from Switzerland that shows that life satisfaction is lower in those parts of the country where there's a high registration of Porsche and Ferraris. So that sort of like illustrates the sort of like, you know, how you can get bogged down by upward social comparisons. So the question is, you know, how do you do those? You know, how do you use that, the fact that we are comparing, and how can you use that more insightfully? And then, you know, planning, you know, a lot of sort of like financial planning, but considering intrinsic motivations, not just, you know, planning for the purpose of like, Excel spreadsheets and cash flow management, etc., but really, you know, considering the things that I mentioned. And then lastly, it's to do with resilience, in the sense that, you know, we're becoming older, we're living longer, healthier lives, and it's sort of inevitable that in those longer, healthier lives that we're living, there'll be some sort of crisis along the way, whether that's an economic crisis, political crisis, financial crisis, a personal crisis. You know, it's gonna come, it's gonna happen. But the question is, how are you sort of behaving? How are you sort of reacting when the inevitable happens? So these are sort of aspects, as I say, they're more sort of behaviorally informed, that we, however, think are really important when seeking to understand financial well-being, when seeking to understand how can we help improve financial well-being in clients or in the general population. It's not just the money side, it's also that mindset side that we think is really important, that is perhaps a bit under-emphasized.
Yeah, definitely. No, that's a really interesting point. And that point you made about comparing yourself to others, I think that sort of comes out in other walks of life as well. There's all that social media and seeing other people's lives and sort of comparing your own to theirs. And yeah,
absolutely. That's
a point from today's society.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really hard to sort of like, I mean, you know, that there's a sort of like basic thing that, you know, it's always been the case that we would be comparing our situation to that of others, right? I'm a trained anthropologist, you know, like anthropological studies, they would have shown that, like, you know, centuries, millennia ago, you know, humans would have compared their situation, you know, they would have compared the quality of crops in the neighboring community, you know, or the amount of rainfall in that valley compared to where we are, etc. You know, it's inevitable to be comparing. But the question is, how do you compare? Are you sort of like comparing in a sort of like evaluative, oh, they have it so good, and I'm struggling here, etc.? Or are you sort of comparing in a way that helps you actually, identify deeper motivations, or, you know, where you can learn from someone, you know, and say, like, oh, this is someone who is in a sort of like slightly, you know, similar position as I am, but he or she is doing this or that really well. And, you know, that's something I can learn from. And, you know, that's a sort of like creative and, you know, better way to compare.
Yeah, definitely. So given how important the role of mindset is, then what can, and given that most of our listeners will be financial advisors, what can they be doing to help clients in sort of reaching a better point of financial well-being?
Yeah,
and
great question.
And also, how much is it their sort of, to what extent should they be helping? Like, how much is it sort of their, I don't know, duty to ensure their clients are financially well?
Yeah, I mean, when you say duty, the question is, of course, is it a sort of like regulatory duty, or is it sort of a moral or ethical, duty? And I would perhaps, you know, emphasize the latter rather than the former. So I would say, you know, absolutely, you know, there is a sort of like, you know, moral duty to be improving your client's financial well-being. I mean, you're a financial advisor, the clue's kind of in the name. I think the opportunities lie in addressing the mindset side, really. Okay, when arguably the money-related financial well-being improvement opportunities have been maximized. Yeah, your chances are you've looked at how to, you know, build the best investment strategy and how to use, you know, the tax benefits there are and the allowances there are, etc. You know, chances are that this has all been done. But and we see this even in the research that we have, that, you know, those who have a financial advisor, their money position is significantly better than that of, you know, non-advised consumers or, you know, members of the general public. Where the improvement opportunities are really on the mindset side. And that's where we see, you know, that those who have a financial advisor, they are oftentimes actually not much more likely to have a good understanding of the things that give them joy and purpose in life. They're not necessarily less likely to be bogged down by social comparisons. And they're not necessarily more likely to have this sort of resilient mindset in times of market volatility. I mean, I know, you know, for many financial advisors that this is causing a lot of angst, you know, when there's market volatility. How can we help people pay attention to, you know, their life goals and their long-term aspirations rather than being bogged down by market volatility or what's happening with all sorts of, like, you know, niche markets? It's, you know, something where I think there are huge improvement opportunities for financial advisors, and it requires another type of skill set. Yeah, that goes beyond the sort of, you know, identifying investment opportunities and, you know, assessing risk appetite and, you know, health span and capacity for loss, etc. All those types of things. That's important. But, you know, other things that are important that are perhaps not, you know, that well trained yet is like certain type of listening skills. Yeah, listening for, like, really zooming into, you know, what are the values of that client? You know, what are, you know, what does that client need so as to be a sort of authentic version of himself or herself? You know, what are the, when he or she is speaking about their current life or what happened in the past or their aspirations in the future, etc. You know, what are they sort of, like, indicating gives them joy and gives them purpose in life? What sort of, like, you know, mental time horizon do they have when they speak about the future? Do they speak about it in quite vague terms, or are they speaking about it in quite concrete terms? And, you know, when, you know, at what point in the future is it that it becomes more vague, so that you know, you as the advisor or financial planner, you can sort of, like, help them stretch that mental time horizon and, you know, think further. As an industry, we're really used to work to thinking in decades. Many clients will struggle to do that. Yeah, they're very much oftentimes, you know, in the here and now, and not likely to be thinking 5, 10, 15 years ahead or so, which is, of course, the time horizons that we in financial services oftentimes have. So, yeah, this is what I would say, you know, the sort of behavioral coaching, psychology, mindset, listening skills, you know, these are opportunities. With that comes some hard skills as well. For example, touch typing. Yeah. So, and I mean it, you know, this sort of, you know, virtual setup of client meetings, that won't go away. Okay. So you will be taking notes, in sort of, like, Teams calls, but to be able to do that whilst looking at the camera, and not sort of, like, you know, head down and sort of, like, you know, the eagle, you know, finding the letters on the keyboard. You know, I think this is kind of related to financial well-being and to sort of, like, you know, appreciating the emotional components of trust and the human, you know, skills that you require so as to build client relationships.
Yeah, definitely. It's really interesting you talking about touch typing and not, you know, putting your head down and keeping your attention on the client. I was actually in some editorial training the other day, and it was about being on video and how it's different from, so it was presentation training. So presenting on video is very different from presenting in person, because you have to, especially if you're reading from an auto cue or something, and newsreaders have to do it a lot. Newsreaders are reading an auto cue, but you wouldn't know. It looks like they're sort of speaking to you, the viewer. It's a very interesting sort of skill set to try and learn. So yeah, very similar for us journalists as well as financial advisors.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can absolutely see why that would be useful to to you. You're also wanting to build rapport. You're also wanting to build a connection with, you know, the viewers or, you know, your customers, if you like. But yeah, the same applies to advisors.
That's really interesting. Great. Well, so I did just want to ask how important the role of education is. So we've talked a lot about mindset. How important is it to educate the client about, because so I was talking to this about this to Alison last episode. There is a lot of sort of financial education material out there.
Yeah.
Often, certainly the basics, like people will know, you know, not to spend money they don't have. They know not to, but quite a lot of people still do it. So how sort of important is education in adjusting or changing clients' mindsets in this way?
Yeah, so I will perhaps say something controversial here. I think there is a sort of like very immediate reaction that when we see low levels of financial well-being, the immediate reaction is, oh, we need to educate people. We need to tell them, you know, that budgeting is good and that having emergency savings is good and that saving for retirement is really necessary, etc. You know, all those things. Problem is, when you tell people, they will go, no shit, I know this. Yeah, that's, you know, because levels of awareness, levels of knowledge are actually pretty high. Okay, the reason they're not doing it is because of all sorts of biases, mental shortcuts that prevent them from following through. And you know what? That doesn't just apply to, you know, doesn't just apply to financial aspects. It applies to a lot of things that require future-oriented behavior. I mean, are we always brushing teeth and flossing teeth the way we should be? You know, are we always eating healthily? Are we getting the amount of exercise? Are we, you know, investing in our social networks? Are we, you know, all those things, you know, we all know what we should be doing, but, you know, oftentimes we're not following through. So I'm not here to say that financial education is useless. I think there's a certain type of financial education that is required. There's two types. One is just-in-time education, and advisors are well placed to do this because they, of course, they are meeting their clients. They know their clients. They're having conversations with them, so they have a good understanding of what sort of education may be required now at this point, for example, when markets go down or, you know, I don't know, when tax year end is due or something, you know, then you can provide that information. So that's good. Just-in-time education, there's a lot of evidence that that is, you know, much more powerful than the sort of conventional financial education, where in turn there's a lot of evidence that this isn't actually that effective. The other type of education that works really well is rules of thumb. Okay, so this is just, and this is something that we've done in our financial well-being flipbook that is downloadable on Aegon's website. We call it general principles there, but it's the same sort of idea that when you give people a sort of like rough indication of, you know, what is a sort of like good enough conduct, then that works much better. So an example could be, you know, an example for a rule of thumb would be a retirement pot size you should aim for is £345,000. Okay. Now, chances are, you know, there are many for whom that is not enough. You know, and you know, it's not specific, of course. You know, that's the point of a rule of thumb. But for many also, you know, it just gives a sort of like rough idea. Oh, okay, right. And that's much easier to remember. And that's much easier to sort of apply in everyday life than any, you know, training on, oh, you know, retirement is built up of, you know, your employer's contribution and there's your payments and you get tax relief and you get, you know, and you have a lifetime allowance and there's an annual allowance and you know, that type of education, you know, doesn't cut it. But something like, aim to have a retirement pot size of £345,000. Okay, yeah. Is much more likely to stick. So those two things, just-in-time education and rules of thumb, are a better, you know, more superior way of financial education, I would argue.
Yeah, definitely. sort of simplifying it for the clients.
Yes.
So just finally then, why is it important for you to get involved with something like the Initiative for Financial Wellbeing? I know you're a keynote speaker at the event, so why is that important to you?
I think for advisors, there are huge opportunities when pursuing a financial well-being agenda. In fact, I think it is, you know, necessary so as to remain in business. We see all sorts of macro trends. Notably, there's the rise of DIY and to a lesser extent, robo. I mean, the figures are massive. When I look at, I think the FT last reported about this in April 2022, and they said something like, Hargreaves, I think, have welcomed another nearly 200,000 new customers to now 1.5 million. AJ Bell welcomed a surge of, I think, 27%. Vanguard Investor, who only started in 2017, they've welcomed another 180,000 customers in last year alone, 2021 alone. So they have now 400,000 customers. So, you know, that's massive, massive growth in those digital first and easily scalable propositions. And I think what this is highlighting is that people are increasingly realizing some of the basics of long-term investing, yeah, that actually, you know, asset allocation and, you know, risk profiling and, you know, diversified cheap trackers, etc. You know, it's not actually that difficult. You don't need like a massive amount of expertise to be able to navigate all this. Yeah. What of course an advisor has that a digital first or scalable proposition does not have is the human relationship, yeah, the advisor client encounter. And then the question is, what are you wanting to use that client encounter for? Are you wanting to use it for, you know, those classic alpha bits, you know, performance of a policy portfolio versus a benchmark portfolio, asset allocation, to talk about cash flow, to talk about like financial goals, etc. You know, that can be easily scalable. Or do you want to use it to talk about things that are more uniquely human? Okay, to be talking about intrinsic motivations, to be talking about values, to be talking about, you know, future aspirations, etc. To then build financial plans around those. There's a beautiful quote from Amy Mullen at Money Quotient in the States. She says, there's no such thing as financial goals. There's life goals with price tags attached.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is a nice way to be sort of like rephrasing the problem. There's a lot of emphasis in financial services on financial goals. But actually, you know, financial goals as such don't exist. You know, you have life aspirations, you have values, you have life goals, and then you've got to build a sort of like financial plan around those. I don't think that DIY propositions and robos are really good at sort of identifying life aspirations and deeper motivations, etc. They're good at sort of like satisfying financial goals. But, you know, the advisor can work with those softer things like life goals, values, etc., to build financial plans around those, to then give, you know, peace of mind, more money, of course, ideally as well, more time to the client, in a way that a digital first scalable service would never be able to do. So I think the focus on financial well-being, or pursuing a financial well-being agenda, you know, offers really many ideas and angles of how to bring that to life, you know, what to actually do, what sort of questions to ask when meeting a prospect in a client review meeting, etc. And then perhaps lastly, what I would say is, you know, that shouldn't be your sort of like main motivation, but we see from research that we've done that actually it pays off to be, for a financial advisor and a financial planner, it pays off to be a well-being maximizer rather than a performance maximizer. We see that those who have that focus on intrinsic motivations and goals and life ambitions, etc., that they are more likely to be reporting high profit margins, they're more likely to get referrals, and they are much more likely to be confident about their business's future. Okay, compared to the number of referrals and profit margins and business confidence amongst performance maximizers, the sort of like classic alpha advisor. So there you have it. You know, I think there are a number of reasons really for why as an advisor or financial planner, you would want to be pursuing this angle.
Yeah, definitely. Keep the human element.
Exactly.
Great. Lovely. Thank you so much, Thomas. It's been really great to chat to you. I've had a great time. And to our listeners, please do keep up to date with all our new releases via Podbean, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and everywhere else that you get your podcasts from. You can find all our new content published on the Money Marketing website, as well as Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram. And we will see you again for our next podcast.